Is this the start of a new bear market, or will the market bounce back?
This is Jerry Toome with Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Toome. Jerry Toome is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Toome Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management, or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.
Welcome to Smart Money with Jerry Toome. This is Michael Williams. Well, Jerry, the market's been bouncing all around the place. We've had a correction occur this month. But I thought before we got into the details of where we think we're headed and why we think we're headed that direction, that it'd be good to kind of back up and look at the bigger picture. How is it that we even look at trends of the economy, of the market, to decide where we think we are and where things will head? Because that helps us adjust our portfolios for our clients.
It does. And Michael, I think it also will help our clients, because I know, you know, our clients tend to listen to this show regularly, and potential clients, and everybody else out there, because we look at the market a little bit differently than a lot of the firms do. And I think that it's helpful to talk about that a little bit. So the predominant theme in the marketplace typically is buy and hold. You know, you have to buy and ride out every correction, every bear market kind of thing. That's not the way we look at the world. And the reason for that is twofold. Number one, most of the clients that we work with, if we're talking about clients, and most of our listening audience is over 60. All right, so it's one thing if you're 45 years old, which you're a little older than that now, but it's one thing to be 45 years old and go through a massive bear market, because the market does tend to always come back. That's still not guaranteed. There's no guarantee in the securities market. But even in 2008, we had a monster crash, the worst of our lifetimes. And, of course, then over time, it took about 4 years to get back to break even if you're looking at the S&P 500. But over time, if you kept after it, and this is especially true if you're doing what we call dollar cost averaging. If a client is putting in money every month.
Like your 401k.
Yeah, you got your 401k, you're putting money in every month. You know, typically in the real easy illustration on this is, okay, if you got $10 a share price and it drops to $5, that's a huge bear market. That's a 50% drop. But if you're putting $100 a month in, just to use a number that's easy to work with mathematically, at $100 a month, $10 a share price, when you're at the top, you're getting 10 shares. When the market drops 50% and it's down to $5 a share, now you're getting 20 shares for the same amount of money. So the dollar cost averaging, while you're in the accumulation phase of your life, the dollar cost averaging tends to work in your favor, although still nothing is ever a guarantee in the securities market or in the stock market. So the issue is, that's one way to work, and that's what we call the accumulation phase of the stock market or the person's life. However, and one of the Nobel Prize winning economist, mathematician kind of guys, William Sharpe, had this comment, and I like what he said, the way he said it. He said, but, and I'm going to say this is a capital B, but, capital B, capital U, capital T, but when you retire, the mathematics change and the emotions change radically. So the vast majority of our clients are either at retirement or near retirement. The majority of our clients are retired. I think most people that listen to this show are older, and I think part of that's because we, by God's grace, tend to be a lot more, what should I say, high-end on the research that you're going to hear on the radio in particular. And so the mathematics, the way we look at it, if you reach what William Sharpe called end period dominance, what does that mean? Okay, let's go back to a recent top in the market, the dot-coms. Most people are going to remember the dot-com era. And if you're 65 now, you were probably 45-ish then, maybe a little bit younger. And so if you, again, were dry, you know, it was a horrific crash. NASDAQ went down almost 80% from the top to the bottom over almost three full years, a three-year bear market, the worst bear market of our generation. Okay, but the issue is, again, if you kept putting money in, and didn't panic, kind of like the old analogy, you want to, if you're going to do that strategy, you tie yourself to the mast and you do not let the sailors take you loose. You ride that storm baby as bad as it's going to get, and it may look carrying, and it may look like you're going to die a million times over, but you hold on. No, you don't hold on. You keep adding. You keep investing more money. So the dollar cost averaging works in your favor there. However, flip that over. Flip it on its head when you retire. When you retire, let's talk about the stocks. If you're taking money out for retirement, not everybody uses their stock accounts for, you know, income. Maybe some of them may have enough in bonds. Maybe you got enough in real estate. Maybe you got a pension or whatever, and you don't need that money for retirement income, and that's best. But a lot of people go into retirement, and they're, okay, I'm going to do a systematic withdrawal. I'm going to take a certain amount of money out of my account every month to meet my retirement goals and what I want to spend money on. And hopefully you have your house paid for by then. Hopefully you're on Social Security. But I've seen this happen countless times where people, oh, well, I took retirement a little early, but I took retirement in 2000. 2 years later, they're working again. Why? Because the bear market was so devastating. When you stop adding new money to it, that's what, again, William Sharp called end period dominance. Whenever your period of accumulation, because you're going through the accumulation phase, from the day you start adding money into 401k or whatever the case is, you're going through the accumulation phase of your life, which works until you get to retirement age, whatever age that is. If you take early retirement at 63, if you go to 65, if you work till you're 70, whatever that number is, that's your accumulation phase. And I've talked to countless clients about this over, the last last 40 years I've been doing this. And I even had one guy who, he came in about 6 months. He said, I'm getting ready to retire in about 6 months, and I want to get all my ducks in a row, and I think I'm going to move my money over here when it's due, when I can. And I said, okay, well, just keep in mind that the way you look at the world and the market right now will change after you retire. And he didn't verbally disagree with me, but he mentally disagreed with me. He told me this story later. He's like, okay. So he kind of nodded his head yes, and then about 6 months after he retired, when we had our next review and he'd moved his money over here, he's now a client, he said, you know, Jerry, I didn't believe you then. I nodded my head, but inside of me, I was going, I'm not going to change. My worldview is not going to change. He said, but you were right. In 6 months of being retired and knowing I have to live on this money for the rest of my life, the emotions were radically different than they were before while he's in his accumulation mm-hmm. phase. So keep in mind, I'm in a long dissertation on why we do what we do the way we do it. But that's the point, is we work with primarily retired people. Now, if you're very young and you want to ride it out the storms, like I said, tie yourself to the mast and go through these massive ups and downs, because they can be quite radical, as we know. In 2008, I don't think this next bear that we have, assuming we're going to have another bear at some point. We're going to talk today about whether that's the current market is going into a bear or not. But regardless, I doubt we'll have another 2008 anytime soon. We might have one in the next decade. If you look at the longer-term stock cycles, there's about an 18-year stock cycle. Again, we may go into that in the second half of the show. But the bottom line is, it looks like we might have another 2008-type market sometime in the early to mid-2030s. Too long to go into right now. It's a little too far out to look. So the bottom line is, you go from your accumulation phase to your retirement phase, and some people have built up enough wealth that it's not a big deal, and some people have built up enough wealth to retire comfortably. But either way, when you go through a bear market and you're dealing with, you know, again, so I like the analogy of Goldilocks and the three bears. You know, so if you go through a correction in the market, and we're going to talk about on today's show, is what we've just been through just a garden variety correction, or is it the beginning of a bear market? And how can you tell? How do you know? Well, you won't know for sure. There's no way to be certain about it. But my suspicion is it's the beginning of the next bear, and we'll explain why that is. And we'll also tell you a lot about the new newsletter that's coming out. Believe it or not, I finally got it almost totally finished. I'll probably wrap it up early next week and send it into compliance. So I would think it probably goes out in the emails about middle of next week is the plan, currently subject to change. But anyway, so the issue is, when you go into retirement and you're retired and now you've got the end period, meaning, okay, I'm not continuing to accumulate a lot of capital in my retirement plan, I'm now going to be spending some of it down, then the math changes. And here's how the math works, because the reason William Sharp called it end period dominance is end. Okay, so let's say hypothetically you got $2 million in your retirement account when you stop working. That's your end period. Then you got to start drawing down that capital. And you probably don't have all of it in stocks, But the bottom line is you most likely will have a big chunk of it in stocks. Let's take the stock part by itself, because the bond side of it is a completely different argument and equation going forward. I don't think bonds are going to behave in the next decade the way they've behaved most of, well, all of my professional career. Since 1980, 1981, Paul Volcker, the chairman at the time, raised interest rates to 21.5%. We've never seen them that high in our lifetimes, and that was a one-time event, and rates have been falling ever since then. But there is a floor. You cannot go below zero. Yeah.
You can't have the same downward trend in rates that we've had the past 20 years.
No.
There's not enough room.
There's not enough room. You can't go below. You know, we were at 2% on most of the, you know, fixed income kind of stuff 3 years right before COVID. And so it just, at this point, that trend has radically turned. Now, again, that's a subject of another show and probably another newsletter on what's going on there. But if you look at the 70s, Alan Greenspan made this statement in around 2017. We got his quote. He said, the next decade will be a decade unlike we've seen since the 1970s, a period of stagflation. Stagflation, let's define that. Stagflation was a term that really they invented in the 70s. I remember when I was an undergraduate or getting my degree, taking a macroeconomic course, the guy that was teaching it was a graduate student, and he's like, yeah, this is, in the old days, they didn't think you could have recession and inflation at the same time. So they had to invent a new term called stagflation, meaning you had accelerating inflation and then you had a stagnant economy at the same time, because the 73, 74 bear market, which is the worst of that generation, you had inflation running 12, 13% at the top, and the unemployment rate was going through the roof because we were going into a recession, which again, they thought was mutually exclusive until that point in time, and then they found out it wasn't. So the issue here is, you've got to look at where we're going forward, and I'll just make this part very, very brief on the bond side of things. I believe that the first wave of inflation, the major wave, is over. We had a little wave of inflation before COVID, not a big one. Then we had a big wave this time, and now we've permanently reset, kind of like you ratchet it up. Now we've locked it in at higher prices on everything else. The rate of growth of inflation has slowed down to 3% or 4%. But I don't think it's going back to 2 in my lifetime, frankly. And so I think what will happen most likely, we're going to have a period of indigestion here, most likely for the next 12 months-ish would be my guess, based on the tariffs, based on potential geopolitical issues. But over time, as the economy goes back into the next phase of the recovery, which I think probably might start in the second half of this year, depending on geopolitics, it might start next year, would be my best guess, probably next year. But after that, we'll go back into acceleration. And the underlying inflation components, if you will, reminds me of, if you ever try to watch, you ever try to boil an egg. Right, you put the pan of water on the stove and you watch it. And what's the old saying? Watch pot will never boil.
Right.
So you wait until you see, what is the first thing that you see? Well, the first things you see are the bubbles forming at the bottom of the pan. Then eventually the bubbles start getting more active, and then eventually the water starts boiling and, you know, churning and all that stuff. Well, I don't see us in an inflationary environment right away, but right now, I don't know. Maybe I can see the bubbles on the bottom of the pan, maybe not. But I think between now and 2030-ish, we're likely to have another big wave of inflation coming. And you see that in the contract negotiations where the consumer, the financial markets and the government and all that, people tend, financial markets in particular, think about, okay, well, inflation's down to 3.5 or whatever. That's a victory. The consumers, on the other hand, think inflation, you know, everything I buy is 30 or 40% higher now than it was before COVID. I'm way behind, and I got to catch up. And so it builds this inflationary psychology, which, again, is what Greenspan talked about back in 2017. The inflationary psychology has come into the marketplace and the United States as a whole. So the consumer's now got more of an inflation awareness than he had before this last shock, which nobody was really ready for the most part. And now he's thinking, okay, I got to get ready for inflation. So I think there's going to be another wave of inflation between now and 2030, 2032-ish. And that's going to most likely continue to crush the bond market. If you look back at the Lehman aggregate since right before COVID, you're at a net loss over that whole period of time. So you got, what, 5 years here now? And bonds, if you were buy and hold bonds and you were in the bond market, government, whatever, let's throw out high yield for a moment because that's a little bit different animal. But if you were in traditional corporate bonds or whatever, you know, and you're worrying about the market value going up or down, you're at a net loss right now over that period of time. So why? Because, again, the bond that you bought paying a certain amount of interest now will have to be discounted to equal the current market rate. So if you were getting 3% then, and you know you can get 4 or 5, 6 or 7 in the marketplace depending on where you're investing.
Yeah, I have no reason to buy your bond.
Exactly.
Because if I go buy one new at 6% and yours is sitting there at 3, I don't like yours.
No.
Unless you offer me a discount for it.
A discount, and the discount means that the value of the bond's gone down.
So that I can make
6%. So that you can make your same 6%, exactly. So anyway. So let's leave that part behind. So I think that inflation is going to make the equation of what we've gotten used to since 1980, 81 different. I also think real estate will come back strong. It's been through a consolidation correction, depending on where you are in the real estate market. But I think we'll have another wave of inflation, number one. Number two, I think we'll have another run of real estate doing well because it's a whole lot more positive correlation, if you will, to inflation. And bonds have a negative correlation to inflation. Bonds perform poorly and or lose money, generally speaking, in an inflationary environment. Real estate typically does not. So anyhow, your asset allocation, in my view, going forward is going to have to be a little bit different. Now, going back to the accumulation phase versus what we call the distribution phase, if you're retired, your math needs to work differently. As we know, a 10% drop, which we just went through with the S&P 500, S&P 500, a 10% drop mathematically means you need 11% to gain it back. That's a correction. Those are things you normally are better off riding out. A 20% drop in the market, which is, NASDAQ didn't get quite that far. I think it was 16. But a 20%, if you look at investment math, 20% loss requires 25% gain to make it back. That's a little more meaningful. But again, the 20% loss is kind of what we call a mama bear. It's not a big one. A 30% loss requires 43% to make it back. So what happens is the more the account goes down, the bigger the return has to be to make it back. A 50% loss is the ones you never want to experience. That's 2008. That's the dot-com crash in 2000. That's the 1974 crash. So we've had three of those in the last 50 years. A 50% drop in market value means you need 100% to make it back, and you don't even think about going past 50%. But the NASDAQ, for example, went down 80% in its crash. That means you need 233% to make it back. So the issue here is part of what we look at, why we're looking at the market the way we do, is number one, you know, the doctors are told first do no harm. Okay, so if I'm working with clients, I'm not willing to subject my clients to the potential for a 50% loss. If that means I make a little less money on the way up in a bull market, so be it. That's the trade-off. I've never seen anybody consistently beat the market on the way up and then not lose money in a bear market. Usually the ones that make the most on the way up lose the most on the way down. And I'm concerned that we're turning into a bear by before the end of this year. So the bottom line is, mathematically, that's how we look at the market. Now, keep in mind, as a smaller firm compared to the big Wall Street guys, we can do things differently. You know, they're like a battleship. It takes them miles, literally, to turn around a battleship or a cruise ship. We're more like a PT boat or a, you know, ski boat. We can turn anytime we want, any way we want. We're not going to blow the market up if we get out or the market are in. So they're really kind of different rules depending on where you fit in the marketplace. If you're one of the big, big, big firms, you're going to tend to be all long all the time. You're probably not going to hedge. You're probably not going to go to money market. You're probably not going to short unless you're running a hedge fund, which those guys obviously do run some hedge funds. But the bottom line is they're going to treat things a lot differently because they have to. An elephant can't sit in a kiddie swimming pool. It will overwhelm the pool. So if you get too big in terms of, you know, last time I looked, no offense to Merrill Lynch, at all. Nothing negative I'm saying at all. I'm just making a comment. Last time I checked, they had about 14,000 advisors. Okay, well, that's different mathematically with 14,000 people. They can't give an all-in or all-out kind of market ever. because they would crash the market themselves if they given all out. So again, our style is a little bit different. Part of it is the way I was brought up. Part of it was I went through the 70s, got in the industry in early 1980. The people that had been in the market in the 70s, the guys that were my older guys that were working with back then, all had horror stories to tell about what they'd been through in the 70s. And they survived, but it was a nightmare for a long time, especially the 72, 74 bear, where the Nifty 50 stocks, which were the darlings of that day, kind of like the Mag 7
Those were the can't-lose stocks of the day.
Can't-lose stocks, and the Nifty 50, there were 50 blue chips. These guys said, we'll never sell these companies, Avon, Clorox, Disney, a bunch of those. And they went down close, typically 85 or 90%. Now, 90% decline means you need 900% to make it back. So, again, you got to run these math situations here. Michael's a statistician by training and teaching at Texas Tech, but the bottom line is it's a different worldview. So, breaking all that down, then how do we look at the market? Why do we look at the market the way we do? Part of our lens that we're going to look through the market, and part of this also was the guy that mentored me, Dr. James McKeever. He was a newsletter writer. He did not manage money for clients, but he was the number one ranked newsletter writer of all time, financial newsletter writer. Back in those days, you know, it wasn't emails, it was paper. So you got a paper newsletter in the mail when he wrote his. But he consistently ranked number one as the top performing. He took a little more risk than a lot of the other guys, but he came out on top on that, and he shared the speaking platform with Reagan and Greenspan, same size pictures back in 1979. It's interesting. So, but anyway, he was a mentor of mine. I interviewed him on a radio show. He said, okay, come on, kid, I like you, and I'll show you a thing or two. And he'd had a recent blow up with his son, so he's like, okay, well, I got a young kid I can show. He's anxious pup, wants to learn. So I learned everything I could learn from the guy, but he was not a buy and hold guy either. So in the 70s, when he came into the industry in the early 80s, buy and hold was almost like a curse word. It's like people that had been through the 70s, because the Dow topped at 1,000 in 1966. In 1982, 16 years later, it was under 1,000. So buy and hold didn't go very well with those guys. They didn't like it. You had a whole new generation of people to do the buy and hold thing to make it work. And then, of course, it worked magnificently after Volcker finally topped out on the interest rate cycle. But anyway, so all this is a long explanation of our philosophy, why we do what we do the way we do. And it's also going to say, how does it impact our viewpoint of the world and the marketplace? So what we're going to do is in the second half of the show, first of all, let me talk about the current market. Right now, it's what we call very oversold. And as I mentioned before, the analogy I always use with oversold, if you're at the ocean, let's say the waves are calm, you're in a bay or whatever, and you get a beach ball out there and you start throwing the beach ball around in the water, if you take that beach ball and you push it down under the surface of the ocean, and you push it down, there's a point in time when you won't be able to push it any further because your weight even will be offset by the buoyancy of that water inside that balloon wanting to pop to the surface. So oversold is like, okay, you're at an extreme pressure down. It's gone down too far in the short run. It's going to bounce back. Now, nothing's ever guaranteed in the marketplace, but right now, and this is on page one of our newsletter, we're showing, based on the bull-bear spread, that we are so oversold, we've had, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4 times in the last decade when we've gotten this oversold. And to understand that fully, you need to get the newsletter so you can see it's a sentiment. So we're looking at the emotions of the players in the market. So the sentiment has not been this low. It was worse in 2000. It was worse in the COVID crash, but not a lot worse. It's worse this time than it was in the previous three or four besides that. So in the short run, very oversold. What does that mean? It means there's a high probability that we get a bounce from here, regardless of what happens with the macro, regardless of what happens with Trump and the tariff wars, regardless of what happens, hopefully we don't have to fight the Iran issue right away. The odds are favoring a bounce because the market, again, is so oversold. Now, but I would just put it this way. If you compare this oversold bottom to where we were, let's say, last July when the Japanese yen trade blew up, it feels different. You know, that one, it was scary to everybody, but we had a bottom and we just started kind of gradually drifting higher. Then we caught more momentum, and then we went back up. Now we're going to new highs again. This one's not feeling that way. This one is, okay, we had a big bounce last Friday, but we're chopping around near the lows, not far off the lows, a little bit above the lows. So I'd say on an intermediate term basis, meaning over the next 2 to 6 months, case could be made. I think probably we're going to have a pretty good rally, 5, 10, 15, I don't know. But I do think the thing you've got to watch, and this is not going to be in this newsletter, but probably the next one, is if you look at the very long-term picture I'm looking at a chart of the NASDAQ and S&P both on plotted monthly. So you're looking at long picture, because we're going to look at short-term, we're very oversold, probably do a bounce, maybe a really big bounce. Longer term, though, we're going to focus the rest of this show on what's in the newsletter about what we think is happening in the very long run and look at the indicators. In other words, let's take the 30,000-foot altitude view. You're up in the plane looking at the ground. Now you get a little bit different viewpoint than if you're down there standing next to the mailbox. So anyway, we'll talk more about that when we come back from the break.
All right, well, before Jerry gets into more specifics, we just wanted to take a few minutes to remind you how you can learn more about Cornerstone Financial. You can find us at cornerstonereport.com. That's cornerstonereport.com. Again, you can find out about us. You can catch up on previous radio shows, previous interviews we've done, and you can find Jerry's previous special reports there. Now, the new one coming out will hopefully be soon. We're hoping next week, and that will be emailed out to everybody. So if you haven't signed up for that email, that is also there on the website. We don't do anything with your information. We don't sell it. We can't. We don't want to. We just want to be able to provide you information. So it's like once a week we send out an email saying, hey, the new radio show is available. If you missed it live, you can catch it on our website or on our podcast. And when newsletters are new, we add those to the email. Otherwise, we're not going to bug you. If you would like to call for a free consultation to see if you qualify to work with us, you can reach us at 1-800-327-4285. That's 1-800-327-4285. And again, as a reminder, if it's simpler for you, we're also on podcasts. You can find us on Spotify and Amazon. There was a little glitch with Apple. We'll get that fixed in the near future. But Spotify and Amazon still have us. You can just search for Jerry Tuma's Smart Money. Again, Jerry's got a nice unique name, so if you just search for Jerry Tuma, it will pull up for you. All right, Jerry. Well, we were talking about the difference between accumulation phase and distribution phase. In accumulation phase, that is where more of the academic way of investing makes a little more sense, because you're dollar cost averaging, you're doing it over a long period of time. That's what I'm encouraging my sons that are in their 20s to do. And you know, they're in an investment that did really well last year, and this year they saw a correction that's more than what you're seeing in the market right now, because it's more aggressive. They're real young, and so they're learning about these ups and downs, but because they've got another 40 years, they're not stressed. And so they're understanding, hey, I just keep putting a little in at a time. It actually can kind of work to my advantage that way. But when we're in the distribution phase, now the emotions change. You're relying on this money. Even if you're not living on that particular part of your investment account, it's just very different. When you're not earning income anymore from a job, you're not putting money in there, but it's just sitting there. You got this large amount of money sitting there, and it's going to affect you more if there's a big correction or a big bear market. Again, corrections, you kind of have to ride through some of those, otherwise you'll miss the upturns. So we're not saying you can miss all the downturns. We just tried to limit the big ones, right?
That's a good way to put it. So it's kind of like having a breaker switch. So, you know, you essentially need a breaker system in your house so that if lightning hits the pole outside of your house, your home, it doesn't burn your house down. It doesn't feed back into the home. So that's kind of the way you could think of it, as a breaker switch. Now, so the issue here is that, again, so our objective and the way we manage money, the way we work with managers that manage our money, is there's got to be a breaker switch type of arrangement. So if the market goes down X amount, because, again, we went through that investment math earlier, 10% decline means you need 11% gain to make it back. No big deal. Garden variety correction, which maybe we've just been through. I think it's going to end up being more than that. But at the point in time right now where we stand, that's what it looks like. A 50% crash, you need 100% to make it back. So that's where you have to have a breaker switch somewhere in there so that you don't go, once you're in your end period dominant phase where you're, okay, I've retired now, so I'm not putting a lot more money back into investments every month like I was before. My end period is when I retire. Then you realize, oh, the mathematics, the equation, and the emotions are vastly different.
And you don't have as much time to make it up.
No, and you don't. Because, again, if you have a big crash, like in the 60s, again, the Dow was at 1,066. 1982, it was under 1,000. All right, so that's a 16-year period of time where the buy-and-hold strategy really did not work very well, unless you just were in the right places, which very few people were. All the popular stuff blew up during that time. The only one that I know of that did extremely well during that time was Warren Buffett. But that's because Warren Buffett had his own unique style, which no one else in the world has been able to duplicate to this point. But it's also because he thought the market got overvalued in 1970, and he wrote all of his investors, said, this is not working. I don't see any value to the market. I'm a value investor. It has to buy low, sell high kind of guy. And he literally closed his partnership and sent their investors all their money back.
So Buffett went to cash.
He went to cash. And, oh, by the way, has he been putting a lot of cash away lately? I don't know what his stats are, but I've seen some. I think he's like 30% in money market right now in cash. So don't quote me because that's probably not precise, but it's close from what I've seen. So Buffett has a pretty good history of going to cash. He went all cash then and just cashed in everything. Then 74, when the bear market hit, he was like a kid eating ice cream all day, and he was just loving it. He was buying everything on the streets he could get his hands on in 74 when the crash hit. So his valuation chart said the market's too expensive when everybody else, all the other lemmings, were running off the cliff. He was saying, no, I'm going to get out, and then he got back in. So does it make sense if the world's most famous investor occasionally goes to cash or has a defense? Maybe so. And I saw him do the same thing in the dot-com era, 99-2000. He looked foolish for a while there. He even admitted it. He said, I don't understand all this technology stuff, and I'm not going there. And so he accumulated enormous amounts of cash, and he looked really the old fuddy-duddy's lost his touch. You know, right. That's what everybody was saying about
this
him.
This is a new market.
It's a new market for, you know, it is. I still remember U.S. News and World Report. New rules for the new market. Well, it was new for a few days, a few months, and then all of a sudden it crashed and everything came back to reality, and Buffett laughed all the way to the, you know, to the ticker tape machine. Anyway, so he jokes about it for the people that do modern portfolio theory. He said, to his partner, Charlie Munger, before he died, he said, Charlie and I should endow these chairs with a whole bunch of money. We should give all these universities a bunch of money in donations to tell them to keep proliferating this stupid idea so that we can make all of our money because we're doing something different that actually works. So anyway, I won't go any further into that one. But anyway, Buffett is not what I would call a buy and hold investor. And here, what is he, 90 years old now? He's still got the same style. Anyway, let's take a look at, and these are going to be some charts that we're going to put into the next newsletter that is in the process now. So what am I trying to do? The goal of this newsletter is to do two things. Number one, let you see what we think are affecting the markets the most. So anyway, on page one of the newsletter, we have a chart showing this is a sentiment. This is AAII. This is American Association of Individual Investors Survey Sentiment Form. And it shows very low sentiment. So the beach ball's been pushed to the bottom as far as you can go down right now, and it's getting ready to pop back to the top most likely. That's the emotion or the sentiment. How bullish or how bearish are you about the market? And we've gone from everybody being hyper bullish to everybody being hyper bearish almost overnight. And so that normally is a sign, hey, we think we're going to likely end up with a bounce, but we'll wait and see. The rest of the newsletter is really devoted to more of the long-term picture. So one of the things that I don't want to say I disagree with it in a way, is the way that the market works is it tends to be super short-term focused most mm-hmm. of the time. So what do you do every quarter? Every quarter the corporations have, you know, their staff, their, you know, CEOs and so forth have an earnings call with the brokerage firms and all the analysts. And they say, okay, here's what we think is happening. And they'll tell you what the short term is. Where do they go past 6 months? Almost never. So the stock market grading system, if you want to call it that, is super, super short term focused 99% of the time. What happens is when you get in, we talked about this in our book From Boom to Bust and Beyond, where we're talking about the fiasco with the subprime derivatives and mortgages and stuff. It's like, okay, the forest is on fire. You're not watching the forest. You're watching the bark on the tree. So the hyper short-term focus, which is greed-driven, it's incentivized that way. A lot of the corporations, they're officers. They have stock options that mature every quarter. You know, everything is geared up to be short-term focused, meaning 6 months-ish is over 6 months is long-term for the Wall Street. So the issue is that works until it stops working. At some point in every cycle, though, it stops working. When does it stop? When we go into a bear. Because, again, most people are not trained on what do the bears look like. Now, that's kind of one of the things I would say is a bit of a specialty of mine, is understanding what do bear markets look like, how do they start, when do they start, what are the things that cause them, and so forth, and understanding that. And I'm not saying, because I'm not really a trader. We've discovered that over time. I'm really more of a long-term analyst, intermediate to long-term analyst. But if you look at the picture from 30,000-foot altitude instead of from, you know, right next to the postman at the post office box type of thing, you're going to get a different viewpoint. Let me go through some charts, and you'll be able to see these. What we want you to do is make sure if you're not signed up for to get my newsletter, we don't charge for it. We probably ought to start charging for it in a few years, but in a few months, but we're not at this point charging for it. Then all you got to do, if you haven't signed up already, many of you are on mine. I just don't write them real frequently. My goal starting this year is to get back. I would like to be putting something out at least every month. But that so far, my wife's health, right now, by the way, has really had some turnaround with her health. As you, many of you know, she had cancer and two strokes. And so she's pretty optimistic right now. We marketed her book at the National Religious Broadcaster. She got in her little wheelchair, drove all around and handed out books to the vendors there in radio and TV. But anyway, so I think things are changing for us, and I sure hope so. Anyway, but going back to what we're looking at here, we're going to be looking at the longer-term indicators. So I'm hoping I'm able to write a newsletter every month going forward. This one will be a longer one. Let's talk about these. Now, first of all, I've got the charts in here. I don't want to rush through them, but I think it deserves a little bit of explanation on each one and what they are. The step chart number one, and again, now we've gone from, we've already told people in the short run, we're very oversold. The normal thing you would see from here is some sort of a bounce. Part of what we determine is if we're starting a bear market will be the quality of that bounce. In other words, if there's a really strong surge of volume and a lot of stocks participating in this, then maybe we'll determine, okay, I don't think we're in a bear yet. But that's the quality of that bounce is going to be, to me, a major determining factor of if we're entering a bear or if this is just a correction. I still, at this point, I still believe we're entering a bear. Well, but I reserve the right to change my opinion later.
I thought it was interesting. Ned Davis, one of our research firms, pointed out that they look at a four-step process for basically a bounce coming. And we're currently on step three of their possible bounce. They're looking towards beginning of April for something to happen.
Yeah.
But they also mentioned in there, hey, that's the usual, but we may, you can also just also drop back to step one and start over.
Yeah, and it could be happening. But anyway, so I want to step back and look at this at the 30,000-foot altitude viewpoint. Imagine if you're up in an airplane looking out the window at the ground. I still remember, real funny, it took me forever. Once I was flying somewhere, and I'm like, there's a giant spotlight on the ground. It's following us everywhere we go. I finally figured out it was the moon reflecting on the side of the plane. So anyhow, but it's funny what you see when you're up high. So the first chart shows stocks as a percentage of household financial assets. You know, so investors can obviously go into stocks, they can go into bonds, other types of financial assets. But this is a chart that goes back, to a mere 1950. All right, so that's older than I am. So that would be 75 years. Now, one of the things you want to look at, again, if you're looking for very long-term top indicators, is when you're hitting excesses, where you're at the highest reading of all time, you're at Mount Everest, or no, not Mount Everest, but K2. That's the second highest mountain in the Himalayas. When you get to points where you haven't been in history before, that's a sign, as to quote the old Lost in Space thing, danger, danger, Will Robinson from the early 60s. The point is, time is like, hey, This is not a comment on anything short term. This is not a 6-month commentary. This is a big picture commentary that probably will last years. But we're now at the highest level in the history of the market. Well, not forever, but going back to 1950. I would imagine if their data went back further to 1950, we would be at the highest of all time. But the data on this chart only goes back to 1950. So if you look at the percentage of assets in a household that's in stocks, we're just under 50%, 47.3%. And the second highest reading ever was in the dot-com craze in 2000, which was 44.9%. And then you had back in the 60s when we started the Nifty 50 era, that was in the 39% in stocks. So past performance is never a guarantee of the future results, no matter what you do. But if you would look at the long-term indicators of how much money are people putting in stocks as a percentage of their household assets, we're at the highest level we've been at ever. Now, could it go higher? Yeah, it could. That's why we're putting in here the potential and probably likelihood of a bounce coming. The question is, have we rolled over the top? Now, next month, I'm planning on putting in some longer-term charts that, to me, show what I think it's too early because we haven't given what I would call a sell signal on these, but major long-term, like the monthly charts on S&P and NASDAQ, look like they've topped out. They haven't confirmed yet. We'll see what happens next. All right, so if you look at it as a percentage of household assets, and again, one of the stats we've got in here, Ned Davis, in his December newsletter, this is Ned Davis Sr., he said, when I see sentiment and valuation bubble in stocks, he said, when everyone turns bullish, the question needs to be asked is, who is there left to buy? And so what happens is when you get to maximum penetration, if you will, on stocks, are you near the top? Probably. We'll see. The next chart is not quite as bad. We're at K2 level, not at Mount Everest. The stocks as a percentage of bonds, cash, and institutions. This is insurance and pension funds. So the bottom line is we're still pretty close to tied with the highest allocation there, which is right at 55%, just about equal with the 2000 era. Foreign held U.S. equities. Now, cannot guarantee anything I'm about to say. I can tell you based on my experience, though, of watching the market cycles and bulls and bears for 44 years, again, can't guarantee you anything with this statement. When foreigners jump into the U.S. market en masse, that usually means you're near a top. They are notorious. I don't know if you remember, there was a guy named Roy Riggles, who was a football player back in the 1950s in the Rose Bowl. And there was a fumble, and he was a center. He never got to carry the ball. He wasn't a receiver or anything less. He never got the glory. He's grunge-out center. I was an offensive lineman. I get that. Anyway, so he gets the ball, gets fumbled. The ball bounces right in his hands. He grabbed the ball. I've got the ball. I can run the ball. He's excited about this. And he gets hit, and he gets spun around, but he didn't fall down. And he gets hit again. He spun around again, but he didn't fall down. And all of a sudden, he starts charging to the end zone the wrong direction. And he ran all the way for a touchdown, which was actually a safety. His teammates are running behind him screaming, no, no, no. And the guy's going, I'm not going to give you the ball. This is my one chance for glory. So he didn't understand what the guy was screaming at him about. Wrong way, Regals. Anyway, so cannot guarantee what I'm about to say, but I will say this. When foreigners get into the U.S. market in a big way, and this is the highest they've been since 1966. The top of that cycle. We're just about tied with that. When the foreigners jump in with everything they've got, that's typically a sign that you may be on the last legs of the bull. So if we look at the amount of cash held in interest rates for mutual funds and other institutions, we're on not only lowest of all time, we've fallen off the map. I mean, the lowest it's ever gotten in the history, this goes back again to 1966, is about a 0.7 ratio of cash to stocks. Now we're at a 0.3. We're way below where we've ever been before. The lowest cash to assets ratio just about ever. If you look at the next chart, which is the book value ratio for the market, stock price to book value ratio, you're at the highest level ever before. When you look at it from the standpoint of the expectations. This is a really good one because we talk about sentiment and we talk about emotions on the market. What are the expectations of investors? How many of them expect the stock market is going to keep doing, going up and up and up? Remember, when you get to the top of the cycle, John Templeton called that the point of maximum optimism. When you reach the point of maximum optimism, then everybody's invested. And at some point, it tops out. It's kind of like the arrow shot into the air. It's going to turn over and go down. The problem is, because everybody is unanimously behind this emotionally, that when the market changes and you start going down, there's a radical emotional reaction the other direction. So you go from overconfidence, you go from, you know, not just buoyant emotions, but, you know, in some cases, prideful action on, hey, we know it's a bull, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, it's like you pull the carpet out from under everybody, and it's like, whoa, what's happening here? So if you look at the percentage of, and again, this chart goes back to 1988, 87, so not into the 50s. This is the percentage of people and how bullish they are about the market in the near term. It's way off the charts. It's the highest it's ever been. It's higher than it was in 2018. It's higher than it was in 2000. The percentage of people that are bullish on stocks is just extraordinarily high right now. If you look at the trend channel, and the trend channel is probably the last chart we're going to show or talk about today. Trend channel, you can go back to the 1920s. Market bounces up and down and up and down. So if you can imagine kind of a upper tilt on the top line and then the bottom line, and it's a channel. Equidistant kind of between the top and the bottom, and the market goes up and down, up and down, up and down. So it hits the top of the channel, goes back to the bottom. Hits the top of the channel, goes back to the bottom. In all cases, though, you're walking for the very long term like this, the man with the yo-yo is walking up the stairs. So down, go back to a higher level. Down, go back to a higher level. And that's how it works over the very long run. In this case, we're over the top of the last trend channel. At the top, not at the top, we're above the top of the trend channel. That's only happened twice before. First time was in 2000, and the previous time was in 1929.
So if you're bouncing up the stairs, now we just bounced into the ceiling.
Yeah, exactly. So the point is, none of this guarantees anything. Markets can keep running. The old saying is, again, I'm not a Keynesian economist, but Keynes said it this way. He said, markets can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. Mm-hmm. And there are times, but think about it. When the dot-com era hit, was it rational to be buying companies that were vapor? They had a business plan written out, usually pretty badly, but everybody was so enthralled with that it was almost like a madness had taken over the market.
As long as their name had dot-com on it.
It had dot-com. Everybody was buying it, and a lot of those companies were vapor. They vanished. They were business plans at best, and they vanished in the next 2 years and left people holding the bag. So the issue here is that there are times when the market is irrational both directions, both on the negative side and on the positive side. I think we've hit an inflection point in terms of the way the market's looking right now for me. So I reserve the right to change my opinion later. I've always said that. What I believe is happening, though, right now is I think we've hit probably a historic top. I frankly do not expect a massive 2008 type of crash from here. The thing that would make me change my opinion is if the situation in the Middle East got out of control. What does out of control mean? I don't know, but I do know this. I know that everything we're seeing from Matt Gerken and even Trump has led me to believe he's kind of seeing this the same way. President Trump is that, okay, we know that Iran is an evil empire, in my view, and they're going to have to be taken out somehow. Somebody has to take them out some point because they're like a mad dog on the loose, and you cannot let them have a nuclear weapon. They've already absolutely said they're going to nuke Israel if they get one, but they're just kind of holding their cards close to their chest. They're not going to tell us. The most recent time Trump said something, they said, absolutely, we will not comply with you, period, over and out. All right, so there's a big confrontation coming. When? I don't know. That's the big joker in the deck to me right now is that going to happen sooner or later? I have no idea. But here's what we hope will happen. What we hope will happen is that Israel has, and again, Matt Gerken, this is also in this special report, is Matt Gerken's newsletter, you know, interview we did with Matt Gerken, excerpts from that. He said 75% probability that Israel will attack this year in 2025. And he said, if you're looking at it from Israel's perspective, the Knesset or whatever, even if Netanyahu gets replaced, the consensus is pretty well strong and absolute over there that, okay, we cannot, after what we've just been through with Hamas, we've been fighting Hezbollah for decades, we cannot allow a situation to get out of control here. Right now, our best odds of trying to take Iran out would be with us today. If we wait 5 years, we'll have a different presidential administration in America. We may or may not have an ally on that at that point in time. And we'll allow our enemies to rebuild and recoup and get stronger again. So now we got to fight stronger enemies again. This is our window. I think it's likely to happen this year. And I think it's at some point, I don't see any alternative to take them out. The people that live in Iran hate the regime, largely. Most of them do. They are refusing to comply with their strict laws in many, many areas. We don't have time to get into that today. But the bottom line is, I think that's the wild card in the whole deck. So may you live in interesting times. If you haven't gotten a newsletter, I think it's going to be titled, although it may change it, The New Bear Market? Then go to our website, cornerstonereport.com, and sign up for it again, cornerstonereport.com.
Jerry Tuma's Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone could help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.